The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison. Chapter 28. Zorarak-Namtsarian. Of the Lord Jus's riding of the Hippogriff to Zorarak, and of the ills encountered by him in that accursed place, and the manner of his performing his great enterprise to deliver his brother out of bondage. Lulled with light-stirring airs, too gentle soft to ruffle her glassy surface, warm incense-laden airs, sweet with the perfume of immortal flowers, the charmed lake of Ravery dreamed under the moon. It was the last hour before the dawn. Enchanted boats that seemed builded of the glowworm's light drifted on the starry bosom of the lake. Over the sloping woods, the limbs of the mountains lowered, unmeasured, vast, mysterious, in the moon's glamour. In remote, high spaces of night, beyond, glimmered the spires of Kostra Pivrarka, and the virgin snows of Romshir and Kostra Bilorn. No bird or beast moved in the stillness. Only a nightingale singing to the stars from a coppice of olive trees near the queen's pavilion on the eastern shore. And that was a note not like a bird's of Middle-earth, but a note to charm down spirits out of the air, or to witch the imperishable senses of the gods when they would hold communion with Holy Night and make her perfect, and all her lamps and voices perfect in their eyes. The silken hangings of the pavilion door, parting as in the portal of a vision, made way for that queen, fosterling of the most high gods. She paused a step or two beyond the threshold, looking down where those lords of Demonland, Spitfire and Brandok Daha, with Gro and Zig and Astar, wrapped in their cloaks, lay on the gowany, dewy banks that sloped down to the water's edge. "Asleep," she whispered, "even as he within sleepeth against the dawn. I do think it is only in a great man's breast sleep hath so gentle a bed when great events are toward. Like a lily, or like a moonbeam strayed through the leafy roof into a silent wood," she stood there, her face uplifted to the starry night, where all the air was drenched with the silver radiance of the moon. And now, in a soft voice, she began supplication to the gods which are from everlasting, calling upon them in turn by their holy names, upon gray-eyed Pallas, and Apollo, and Artemis the fleet huntress, upon Aphrodite, and Hera, queen of heaven, and Ares, and Hermes, and the dark-tressed Earth-shaker. Nor was she afraid to address her holy prayers to him who from his veiled porch beyond Acheron and Leith binds to his will the devils of the undergloom, nor to the great Father of all, in whose sight time from the beginning until today is but the dipping of a wand into the boundless ocean of eternity. So prayed she to the blessed gods, most earnestly requiring them that under their countenance might be that ride, the like whereof earth had not known, the riding of the Hippogriff, not rashly and by an ass, as heretofore to his own destruction, but by the man of men who with clean purpose and resolution undismayed should enforce it carry him to his heart's desire. Now in the east, beyond the feathery hilltops and the great snow wall of Romshir, the gates were opening to the day. The sleepers wakened and stood up. There was a great noise from within the pavilion. They turned wide-eyed, and forth of the hangings of the doorway came that young thing, new-hatched, pale and doubtful as the new light which trembled in the sky. Jus walked beside it, his hand on the sapphire mane. High and resolute was his look as he gave good morrow to the queen, to his brother, and his friends. No word they said, only, in turn, gripped him by the hand. The hour was upon them. For even as day, striding on the eastern snowfield, stormed night out of high heaven, so, and with such a swift increase of splendor, was might bodily, and the desire of the upper air, born in that wild steed. It shone as if lighted by a moving lamp from withinward, sniffed the sweet morning air, and whinnied, pawing the grass of the waterside, and tearing it up with its claws of gold. Just patted the creature's arching neck, looked to the bridle he had fitted to its mouth, made sure of the fastenings of his armor, and loosened in the scabbard his great sword. And now up sprang the sun. The queen said, "Remember, when thou shalt see the lord thy brother in his own shape, that is no illusion. Mistrust all else. And the almighty gods preserve and comfort thee." Therewith the hippogriff, as if maddened by the daybeams, plunged like a wild horse, spread wide its rainbow pinions, reared, and took wing. But the Lord Jus was sprung astride of it, and the grip of his knees on the ribs of it was like brazen clamps. The firm land seemed to rush away beneath him to the rear. The lake and the shore and islands thereof showed in a moment small and remote, and the figures of the queen and his companions like toys, then dots, then shrunken into nothingness. And the vast silence of the upper air opened and received him into utter loneliness. In that silence, earth and sky swirled like the wine in a shaken goblet, as the wild steed rocketed higher and higher in great spirals. A cloud, billowy white, shut in the sky before them. Brighter and brighter it grew in its dazzling whiteness as they sped toward it, until they touched it, and the glory was dissolved in a gray mist that grew still darker and colder as they flew, till suddenly they emerged from the further side of the cloud into a radiance of blue and gold, blinding in its glory. So for a while they flew with no set direction, only ever higher, till at length, obedient to Jus's mastery, the hippogriff ceased from his sports and turned obediently westward, and so, in a swift straight course, mounting ever, sped over ravery toward the departing night. And now indeed it was as if they had verily overtaken night in her western caves. For the air waxed darker about them, and always darker, until the great peaks that stood round Ravery were hidden, and all the green land of Zimiamvia, with its plains and winding waters and hills and uplands and enchanted woods, hidden and lost in an evil twilight. And the upper heaven was ateem with portents, whole armies of men skirmishing in the air, dragons, wild beasts, bloody streamers, blazing comets, fiery strakes, with other apparitions innumerable. But all silent, and all cold, so that Jus's hands and feet were numbed with the cold, and his mustachios stiff with hoarfrost. Before them now, invisible till now, loomed the gaunt peak of Zora Rock, black, wintry, and vast, still towering above them, for all they soared even higher, grand and lonely above the frozen wastes of the Tsarion glaciers. Jus stared at that peak till the wind of their flight blinded his eyes with tears, but it was yet too far for any glimpse of that which he hungered to behold. No brazen citadel, nor no coronal of flame, no watcher on the heights. Zora, like some dark queen of hell that disdains that presumptuous mortal eyes should dare to look lovely on her dread beauties, drew across her brow a veil of thundercloud. They flew on, and that steel-blue pall of thunderous vapor rolled forth till it canopied all the sky above them. Jus tucked his two hands for warmth into the feathery armpits of the hippogriff's wings, where the wings joined the creature's body. "So bitter cold it was. His very eyeballs were frozen and fixed. But that pain was a light thing beside somewhat he now felt within him, the like whereof he never before had known. A death-like horror, as of the houseless loneliness of naked space, which gripped him at the heart. They landed at last on a crag of black obsidian stone, a little below the cloud that hid the highest rocks. The hippogriff, crouched on the steep slope, turned its head to look on Jus. He felt the creature's body beneath him quiver. Its ears were laid back, its eye wide with terror. "Poor child," he said. "I have brought thee an ill journey, and thou but 1 hour hatched from the egg." He dismounted, and in that same instant was bereaved, for the hippogriff, with a hoarse scream of terror, took wing, and vanished down the murk air, diving headlong away to eastward, back to the world of life and sunlight. And the Lord Jus stood alone in that region of fear and frost and the soul-quailing gloom under the black summit rocks of Zora Rock. Setting, as the Queen had counseled him to do, his whole heart and mind on the dread goal he intended, he turned to the icy cliff. As he climbed, the cold cloud covered him, yet not so thick but he might see 10 paces distance before and about him as he went. Ill sights a know, and a know to quail a strong man's resolution, showed in his path. Shapes of damned fiends and gorgons of the pit running in the way, threatening him with death and doom. But Jus, gritting his teeth, climbed on and through them, they being unsubstantial. Then up rose an eldritch cry, "What man of Middle-earth is this that troubleth our quiet? Make an end! Call up the basilisks! Call up the golden basilisk, which bloweth upon and setteth on fire whatsoever he seeth! Call up the starry basilisk, and whatso he seeth, it immediately shrinks up and perisheth! Call up the bloody basilisk, who if he see or touch any living thing, it floweth away, so that naught there remaineth but the bones!" That was a voice to freeze the marrow. Yet he pressed on, saying in himself, "All is illusion, save that alone she told me of." And naught appeared, only the silence and the cold, and the rocks grew ever steeper, and their ice glaze more dangerous, and the difficulty like the difficulty of those barriers of Emshir, up which, more than 2 years ago, he had followed Brandach Daha, and on which he had encountered and slain the beast Manticora. The leaden hours drifted by, and now night shut down, bitter and black and silent. Sore weariness bodily was come upon Jus, and his whole soul weary withal, and near to death, as he entered a snow-bedded gully that cut deep into the face of the mountain, there to await the day. He durst not sleep in that freezing night, scarcely dared he rest lest the cold should master him, but must keep forever moving and stamping and chafing hands and feet. And yet, as the slow night crept by, death seemed a desirable thing that should end such utter weariness. Morning came, with but a cold alteration of the mist from black to gray, disclosing the snow-bound rocks, silent, dreary, and dead. Jus, enforcing his half-frozen limbs to resume the ascent, beheld a sight of woe too terrible for the eye. A young man helmed and graved in dark iron, a blackamoor with goggle eyes and white teeth a-grin, who held by the neck a fair young lady kneeling on her knees and clasping his as in supplication, and he most bloodily brandishing aloft his spear of 6 foot of length, as minded to reave her of her life. This lady, seeing the Lord Jus, cried out on him for succor very piteously, calling him by his name and saying, Lord Joseph Demonland, have mercy, and in your triumph over the powers of night, pause for an instant to deliver me, poor afflicted damosel, from this cruel tyrant. Can your towering spirit, which hath quarried upon kingdoms, make a stoop at him? Oh, that should approve you noble indeed, and bless you for ever. Surely the very heart of him groaned, and he clapped hand to sword, wishing to right so cruel a wrong. But on the motion he bethought him of the wiles of evil that dwelt in that place, and of his brother, and with a great groan passed on. In which instant he beheld sidelong how the cruel murderer smote with his spear that delicate lady, and detrenched and cut the two master veins of her neck, so as she fell dying in her blood. Just mounted with a great pace to the head of the gully, and looking back, beheld how Blackamoor and Lady both were changed into two coiling serpents. And he labored on, shaken at heart, yet glad to have so escaped the powers that would have limed him so. Darker grew the mist, and heavier the brooding dread, which seemed elemental of the airs about that mountain. Pausing well-nigh exhausted on a small stance of snow, just beheld the appearance of a man armed, who rolled prostrate in the way, tearing with his nails at the hard rock and frozen snow, and the snow was all one gore of blood beneath the man. And the man besought him in a stifled voice to go no further, but raise him up and bring him down the mountain. And when Jus, after an instant's doubt betwixt pity and his resolve, would have passed by, the man cried and said, "Hold, for I am thy very brother thou seekest, albeit the king hath by his art framed me to another likeness, hoping so to delude thee. For thy love's sake, be not deluded." Now the voice was like to the voice of his brother Goldry, howbeit weak. But the Lord just bethought him again of the words of Sophonisba the queen, that he should see his brother in his own shape, and naught else must he trust. And he thought, "It is an illusion, this also." So he said, "If that thou be truly my dear brother, take thy shape." But the man cried, as with the voice of the Lord Goldry Blushko, "I may not, till that I be brought down from the mountain. Bring me down, or my curse be upon thee forever." The Lord just was torn with pity and doubt and wonder to hear that voice again of his dear brother so beseeching him. Yet he answered and said, "Brother, if that it be thou indeed, then bide till I have won to this mountain top and the citadel of brass which in a dream I saw, that I may know truly thou art not there but here. Then will I turn again and succour thee. But until I see thee in thine own shape, I will mistrust all. For hither I came from the ends of the earth to deliver thee, and I will set my good on no doubtful cast, having spent so much and put so much in danger for thy dear sake." So with a heavy heart he set hand again to those black rocks, iced and slippery to the touch. Therewith uprose an eldritch cry, "Rejoice, for this earthborn is mad! Rejoice, for that was not perfect friend that relinquished his brother at his need!" But just climbed on, and by, looking back, beheld how in that seeming man's place writhed a grisful serpent. And he was glad, so much as gladness might be in that mountain of affliction and despair. Now was his strength near gone, as day drew again toward night, and he climbed the last crags under the peak of Zora. And he, who had all his days drunk deep of the fountain of the joy of life, and the glory and the wonder of being, felt ever deadlier and darker in his soul that lonely horror which he first had tasted the day before, at his first near sight of Zora, while he flew through the cold air portent-laden, and his whole heart grew sick because of it. And now he was come to the ring of fire that was about the summit of the mountain. He was beyond terror or the desire of life, and trod the fire as it had been his own home's threshold. The blue tongues of flame died under his foot-tread, making a way before him. The brazen gates stood wide. He entered in. He passed up the brazen stair. He stood on that high roof floor which he had beheld in dreams. He looked, as in a dream, on him he had crossed the confines of the dead to find. Lord Goldry Blushko, keeping his lone watch on the unhallowed heights of Zora. Not otherwise was the Lord Goldry, not by a hair's breadth, than as Jus had aforetime seen him on that first night in Kostra Belorn, so long ago. He reclined, propped on one elbow, on that bench of brass, his head erect, his eyes fixed as on distant space, viewing the depths beyond the starshine, as one waiting till time should have an end. He turned not at his brother's greeting. Just went to him and stood beside him. The Lord Goldry Blushko moved not an eyelid. Just spoke again and touched his hand. It was stiff and like dank earth. The cold of it struck through Jus's body and smote him at the heart. He said in himself, "He is dead." With that the horror shut down upon Jus's soul like madness. Fearfully he stared about him. The cloud had lifted from the mountain's peak and hung like a pall above its nakedness. Chill air that was like the breath of the whole world's grave. Vast blank cloud barriers, dim far forms of snow and ice, silent, solitary, pale, like mountains of the dead. It was as if the bottom of the world were opened and the truth laid bare. The ultimate nothing. To hold off the horror from his soul, just turned in memory to the dear life of earth, those things he had most set his heart on, men and women he loved dearest in his life's days. Battles and triumphs of his opening manhood, high festivals in Galing, golden summer noons under the Westmark pines, hunting morns on the high heaths of Mialand, the day he first backed a horse of a spring morning in a primrose glade that opened on Moonmere, when his small brown legs were scarce the length of his forearm now, and his dear father held him by the foot as he trotted, and showed him where the squirrel had her nest in the old oak tree. He bowed his head, as if to avoid a blow. So plain he seemed to hear somewhat within him crying with a high voice and loud, "Thou art nothing, and all thy desires and memories and loves and dreams, nothing. The little dead earth-louse were of greater avail than thou, were it not nothing, as thou art nothing, for all is nothing, earth and sky and sea and they that dwell therein. Nor shall this illusion comfort thee, if it might, that when thou art abolished, these things shall endure for a season, stars and months return, and men grow old and die, and new men and women live and love and die and be forgotten. For what is it to thee that shall be as a blown-out flame? And all things in earth and heaven, and things past and things for to come, and life and death and the mere elements of space and time, of being and not being, all shall be nothing unto thee, because thou shalt be nothing for ever." And the Lord just cried aloud in his agony, "Fling me to Tartarus! Deliver me to the black internal furies! Let them blind me, seethe me in the burning lake! For so should there yet be hope! But in this horror of nothing is neither hope, nor life, nor death, nor sleep, nor waking, forever, forever. In this black mood of horror he abode for a while, until a sound of weeping and wailing made him raise his head, and he beheld a company of mourners walking one behind another about the brazen floor, all cloaked in funeral black, mourning the death of Lord Goldree Blushko. And they rehearsed his glorious deeds, and praised his beauty and prowess and goodliness and strength, soft women's voices lamenting, so that the Lord Jus's soul seemed, as he listened, to arise again out of annihilation's waste. And his heart grew soft again, even unto tears. He felt a touch on his arm, and looking up, met the gaze of two eyes gentle as a dove's, suffused with tears, looking into his from under the darkness of that hood of mourning. And a woman's voice spake and said, "This is the observable day of the death of Lord Goldree Blushko, which hath been dead now a year. And we, his fellows in bondage, do bewail him, as thou mayst see, and shall so bewail him again, year by year, whiles we are on life. And for thee, great Lord, must we yet more sorrowfully lament, since of all thy great works done, this is the empty guerdon, and this the period of thine ambition. But come, take comfort for a season, since unto all dominions fate hath set their end, and there is no king on the road of death." So the Lord Jus, his heart dead within him for grief and despair, suffered her to take him by the hand and conduct him down a winding stairway that led from that brazen floor to an inner chamber fragrant and delicious, lighted with flickering lamps. Surely life and its turmoil seemed faded to a distant and futile murmur, and the horror of the void seemed there but a vain imagination under the heavy sweetness of that chamber. His senses swooned. He turned toward his veiled conductress. She, with a sudden motion, cast off her mourning cloak, and stood there, her whole fair body bared to his gaze, open-armed, a sight to ravish the soul with love and all delight. Well nigh had he clasped to his bosom that vision of dazzling loveliness. But fortune, or the high gods, or his own soul's might, woke yet again in his drugged brain remembrance of his purpose, so that he turned violently from that bait prepared for his destruction, and strode from that chamber up to that roof where his dear brother sat as in death. Just caught him by the hand. "Speak to me, kinsman. It is I, Jus. It is Jus, thy brother." But Goldree moved not, neither answered any word. Jus looked at the hand resting in his, so like his own, to the very shape of the fingernails and the growth of the hairs on the back of the hand and fingers. He let it go, and the arm dropped, lifeless. "It is very certain," said he, "thou art in a manner frozen, and thy spirits and understanding frozen and congealed within thee." So saying, he bent to gaze close in Goldree's eyes, touching his arm and shoulder. Not a limb stirred, not an eyelid flickered. He caught him by the hand and sleeve, as if to force him up from the bench, calling him loudly by his name, shaking him roughly, crying, "Speak to me, thy brother! It's across the world to find thee!" But he abode a dead weight in Jus's grasp. "If thou be dead," said Jus, "then am I dead with thee, but till then I'll ne'er think thee dead." And he sat down on the bench beside his brother, taking his hand in his, and looked about him. Naught but utter silence. Night had fallen, and the moon's calm radiance and the twinkling stars mingled with the pale fires that hedged that mountaintop in an uncertain light. Hel loosed no more her denizens in the air, and since the moment when Jus had, in that inner chamber, shaken himself free of that last illusion, no presence had he seen, nor simulacrum of man or devil, save only Goldry his brother. Nor might that horror any more master his high heart, but the memory of it was but as the bitter chill of a winter sea that takes the swimmer's breath for an instant as he plunges first into the icy waters. So with a calm and a steadfast mind the Lord Jus abode there, his second night without sleep, for sleep he dared not in that accursed place. But for joy of his found brother, albeit it seemed there was in him neither speech nor sight nor hearing, Jus scarce wist of his great weariness. And he nourished himself with that ambrosia given him by the queen, for well he thought the uttermost strength of his body should now be tried in the task he now decreed him. When it was day, he arose, and taking his brother Goldry bodily on his back, set forth. Past the gates of brass Jus bore him, and past the barriers of flame, and painfully, and by slow degrees, down the long northern ridge which overhangs the Tsarion glaciers. All that day, and the night following, and all the next day after were they on the mountain. And well nigh dead was Jus for weariness, when on the second day, an hour or two before sundown, they reached the moraine. Yet was triumph in his heart, and gladness of a great deed done. They lay that night in a grove of strawberry trees, under the steep foot of a mountain some 10 miles beyond the western shore of Ravery, and met Spitfire and Brandok de Ha, who had waited with their boat 2 nights at the appointed spot, about eventide of the following day. Now, as soon as Jus had brought him off the mountain, this frozen condition of the Lord Goldry was so far thawed that he was able to stand upon his feet and walk. But never a word might he speak, and never a look they got from him, but still his gaze was set and unchanging, seeming, when it rested on his companions, to look through and beyond them, as at some far thing seen in a mist, so that each was secretly troubled, fearing lest this condition of the Lord Goldry Blushko should prove remediless, and this that they now received back from prison, but the poor remain of him they had so much desired. They came aland, and brought him to Sophonisba the queen, where she made haste to meet them on the fair lawn before her pavilion. The queen, as if knowing beforehand both their case and the remedy thereof, took by the hand the Lord Jus, and said, O my lord, there yet remaineth a thing for thee to do to free him, throughly, that hast outfaced terrors beyond the use of man to bring him back. A little stone indeed to crown this building of thine, and yet without it all were in vain, as itself were vain without the rest that was all thine. And mine is this last, and with a pure heart I give it thee. So saying, she made the Lord Jus bow down, till she might kiss his mouth, sweetly and soberly, one light kiss. And she said, This give unto the Lord thy brother. And Jus did so, kissing his dear brother in like manner on the mouth. And she said, Take him, dear my lords. And I have utterly put out the remembrance of these things from his heart. Take him, and give thanks unto the high gods because of him. Therewith the Lord Goldry Blushko looked upon them, and upon that fair queen, and the mountains, and the woods, and the cool lake's loveliness, as a man awakened out of a deep slumber. Surely there was joy in all their hearts that day. End of chapter 28.